On Tech News Today, we'll tell you what it's like to wear the Apple Watch in real life. Plus, Google's planning two huge new services, and we'll tell you all about the new Tesla. We got great journalists from Bloomberg View, USA Today, BuzzFeed, TechCrunch, Jalopnik, and the Next Web. So stick around. Tech News Today is next.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
It's time for Twit's annual audience survey, and we want to hear from you. Please visit twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. It only takes a few minutes, and your anonymous feedback will help us make Twit even better. We thank you so much for your continued support. twit.tv/survey.
This is Tech News Today for Wednesday, April 8th, 2015. This episode is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 50-plus job sites, including social networks, all with a single click. Screen, rate, and hire the right candidates fast. Try ZipRecruiter with a free 4-day trial now at ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. That's ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. And by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used iPhone, iPad, and other Apple products are worth at Gazelle.com. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. Welcome to the show. I'm Mike Elgin. And our co-anchor today is Bloomberg View tech columnist Katie Benner. Welcome, Katie.
Hey, thanks so much.
So glad you're here. And hopefully we also have Madonna here. She tried to launch or debut her Ghost Town music video on Meerkat yesterday, and there was just a giant number 500. Big error message with little Meerkat. Let's check in on Madonna now and see if it's succeeding today. Stream over. All right. Well, that was quick. It has to be said that Ben Rubin, the CEO of Meerkat, made it clear yesterday that the problem was not a lack of bandwidth capability by Meerkat itself. So just to be clear on that, we don't know what the problem was, whether it was, who knows, could have been anything. Well, Katie, what do you say we jump into the news? We have a lot of interview guests today, so let's get into it. The embargo lifted today, and the Apple Watch reviews are hitting the internet. Ed Begg writes about personal technology for USA Today and joins us now. Welcome to you, Ed.
Good to be here.
Now, you've been wearing the Apple Watch for a week. Tell us, what's it like?
It's a watch, and it's a very good-looking watch. What's interesting is, as I sort of wandered around, you know, you're under embargo. You're supposed to use these things in the real world, but you're not really supposed to show it off. And I was curious how many people would actually notice it, and there were a few who did. But mostly, it's a very good-looking watch that blends in, and I should say watch as, because, of course, there's more than one style here. Mine is the Milanese Loop. Sort of mid-tier, $699. You can, of course, start at $349 and go on up to $17,000. And as I said in my review, even if I can afford that, I think I'd be afraid to wear it in public.
Okay, so you've had it for a week. What are the best and worst things about having the watch?
Well, let me start with the negative, because why not? There is a learning curve here. It takes a couple of days to kind of get up to speed. I mean, there's this much ballyhooed digital crown, which looks like the crown that's on old-fashioned watches to change the time and the date. You use that for everything from scrolling to as a substitute for the pinch and zoom gesture that we're all familiar with on our phones. And one of my first inclinations was to actually try to pinch and zoom on the screen here, which you cannot do. You use the digital crown for that purpose. There's swiping, there's tapping, there's using the various buttons on the side. So there's a bit of a learning curve. You do get the hang of it, but it might take a couple of days. One of the features that I did not think was wonderful was the Dick Tracy feature, the idea that you can make calls on your wrist or take calls on your wrist. The volume on the speaker here is just not very loud. So in my car, that was a difficult experience, and out in Times Square, that was a difficult experience. So those are a couple of the sort of starting with the negative stuff. On the positive side, Apple Pay worked remarkably well here. I tried it in Whole Foods and McDonald's, and it's actually easier than using Apple Pay on the iPhone because, A, you don't have to pull out your iPhone from your pocket. You just kind of hit the side button here twice. Your credit card, which, of course, you've already put in there ahead of time, pops up. Just put it right by the terminal. Worked very, very smoothly. So that's definitely a plus. I had some fun trying out different things. I opened the hotel room door at the W Hotel in New York. That was kind of fun. But the basic stuff you're going to do is, you know, notifications and, you know, the idea that, again, and we've, of course, seen this with our smartwatches, too, where you're glancing at your wrist and you're seeing, oh, this is an email I better address right away or a message I better address right away.
Now, one of the features that Apple talked a lot about was its haptics or its taptics engine, which is often associated with events that take place or visuals or things that you do with the hardware. What was your experience with the haptics? Did you like it? Was it useful?
It was useful. It you kind of get used to it. You know, again, part of the learning curve is like, you know, it can be a distraction at first. But you can muck around with the settings in the settings on the phone, which has an Apple Watch app. And once you do that, I actually found it was useful. It's a way to kind of tip you off that there's something that you may want to glance at, get your attention. But it's not done in a way that I found overly distracting. Again, once I sort of got accustomed to it.
And using this watch actively for a week, did you find that the battery life was any good?
Well, any good is a relative term. It's as good as my phone, which suggests you have to charge it every night, which I did. Apple's saying about a day and a half, and that seems about right based on my usage. I did charge it every night, had the charger by my bed, and, you know, I would charge it, I don't know, let's say 10 o'clock at night. I still had, you know, roughly 30% battery life left, so that's pretty good. Obviously, if you're going out on the road, don't forget the charger. It's a proprietary charger. Yet one more thing you have to carry and, you know, think about. So battery life is relative. Of course, with a dumb watch, you never have to worry about battery life, right? You know, you replace your battery once a year or whatever it is. With some other smartwatches like Pebble, they're claiming a week of battery life. So as long as you think about this the same way you think about your phone, having to charge on a daily basis, you'll be okay. It's not going to do a lot better than that, but at least it got me through that all-important day.
Ed, are you going to buy one? And if so, which one?
I think I am going to buy one. And it's funny, everybody asks that question. And I pointed out in my review, you know, belaboring the obvious, this is not a phone. It's not essential like a phone. But I want it anyway. And yeah, I'm going to buy one. And I'm probably going to buy the one, something similar to the one I've been wearing, again, this Milanese Loop springing, you know, $699. It's not the cheapest one out there, but it's also not the $17,000 watch that you can drool over. But as I said, I'd be afraid to be seen publicly with it.
Ed Begg writes timely articles about wearable computing devices and other things at usatoday.com. And you can follow him on Twitter at Ed Begg. That's EDBAIG. Thanks for joining us today, Ed.
Absolutely. Pleasure.
Let us know what you're going to do about the Apple Watch. You're going to buy one, and if so, which one? Or if you're not going to buy one, and if not, why not? Just send email to tnt@twit.tv and let us know. All right. Well, Katie is telling me on the back channel here, Jason, that Madonna is actually doing something as we speak on Meerkat. Let's take a look. Okay, so 3,700 people. Wow, it's going up fast.
Wow, her Meerkat is so much more professional looking than mine.
Yeah, I did a music video too. It didn't go so well.
She has lighting and fire.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
So there it is. Well, you know, I think the big news is, it's over 4,100 now. It's just skyrocketing in size. I've never seen a Meerkat with this many simultaneous viewers. What's interesting about this, on the one hand, is that she chose or happened to make a deal with Meerkat instead of Periscope. The other thing is that it kind of validates to some degree Meerkat as a sort of place where major, you know, celebrities do interesting things. I guess if a music video is interesting. So we're up to 4,500 now watching. So, you know, kind of interesting.
If only she could work that magic on Tidal. the, you know, live broadcast is an immediacy, and I think in a value that just being able to put up an exclusive video on, you know, the title streaming service is not going to have. So, you know, she made the right choice.
Yeah, and well, you know, she did sign the title promise to, you know, do everything first on title, and then they put a 15-second clip on title. And then she's actually debuting it on Meerkat. So maybe she didn't read the fine print of whatever it is that, they, all those celebrities were signing. That was a weird press conference, the title press conference.
She mounted the table when she signed.
Yeah,
the,
yeah. She maybe smudged her signature.
Maybe her knee covered that part.
Right. It's like crossing your fingers. Just smudge the signature with your knee. I'll try that next time I sign something. Well, okay. Well, thanks, Madonna, for doing that. Finally got it working, and kind of interesting, sort of, kind of. We'll get some more news for you in just a sec, but first let's talk about hiring people. One of our sponsors today is ZipRecruiter, and ZipRecruiter is going to help you with your next hire. They're going to help you by, number one, helping you hire the best person, and number two, making it much, much easier than it normally would be. They help you hire the right person because you can post to 50-plus job sites, including the social networks, all with a single click, and you can screen, rate, and hire the right candidates very, very fast. You know, this is the problem. There isn't one place where all the qualified candidates are. They're scattered to the wind. And, of course, ZipRecruiter will help you cast the widest possible net so that you can get your job opening. You can get exposure, the kind of exposure that you need. And ZipRecruiter now has something called the Premium Traffic Boost. You can get up to 3 times more candidates. It basically just puts your job everywhere, and it's just a great way to get a lot of interest right away. You can quickly screen applicants, rate them, and hire the right first person fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter's been used by more than 200,000 businesses. And right now, our listeners and viewers can try ZipRecruiter for free. Plus, get 30% off your first traffic boost by going to ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. That's ZipRecruiter.com. Don't forget the slash TNT part. And we thank ZipRecruiter for their support of Tech News Today. A few minutes before yesterday's show, Carolyn O'Donovan with BuzzFeed News broke the story that Google is working on a competitor to Amazon Home Services. We mentioned it on the show, but we didn't get into the details. Well, today we've got Carolyn as our guest to talk about her exclusive. Welcome, Carolyn.
Hi, Mike. How's it going?
It's going great, thanks. Now, what have your sources told you about Google's plans?
So what I've heard so far is that Google's working on a sort of ad product. It'll be announced later this spring, something that's going to try and connect local home service providers with consumers who are doing searches. So it's a direct search integration. So it's not a separate website along the lines of something like Google Shopping, but someone who would actually be searching for, I don't know, plumber or leaky faucet, something like that, would actually see something built right into Google search that would encourage them to connect with a local service provider who's working with Google. The way in which that connection would happen, we don't know yet.
Now, does this compete in any way with Google's advertisers who offer really similar products already?
From what I've heard, Google will be working with their existing advertisers on the product.
And will this be similar to Google Compare, or will it be part of Google Compare? How does it compare with Google Compare?
I don't think part of Google Compare. I in the article did bring up Google Compare as an example of another way in which Google was was working to sort of build right directly into the search process. That's a great piece of feature art there. I really like that one. Was working to build directly into the search process a connection between the person who's actually doing the searching but doesn't necessarily know the company or business or whatever it is that they want to connect with. So to get that image to come up, all you actually search is car insurance. So I just moved to San Francisco. Maybe I want to buy a car. I search car insurance. Google shows me right there a way that I can actually, through Google, figure out what that would cost me. I think that that's something similar to how the home services product could look, especially in that it is connected to advertising and that it is a direct integration into the search product.
Got it. So when Amazon announced something really similar, they said that they were going to partner with TaskRabbit. And I'm wondering if you've heard anything about Google partnering with a specific company like that.
Definitely haven't heard anything about who Google might be partnering with. I think it would make sense that they would at first look at people they already have advertising relationships with, for example. But in terms of partnering with like a third party, I mean, there are a handful, right, of TaskRabbit-like companies that do try to connect individuals who want to make a quick buck doing other people's chores and stuff. But I haven't heard anything about Google working with anyone like that.
Well, I love this new world of being able to dial up services because I don't want to do my chores. That's for sure. I'm more of an ideas guy, not really a... Anyway, Carolyn O'Donovan is at BuzzFeed.com. You can follow her on Twitter at CEO Donovan. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much to both of you.
All right. The same Russian group that hacked the U.S. State Department for months also breached the White House's unclassified computer system, it turns out. Kat Zakrzewski writes for TechCrunch and joins us now to talk about it. Welcome, Kat.
Hi, Mike. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Now, what was compromised at the White House exactly?
So right now, we just know that it was an unclassified system, but even the unclassified systems at the White House have a lot of sensitive information. So we do know that the hackers did have access to things like the president's schedule, which normally isn't publicized. And, you know, the ramifications that that could have for spies are very large.
And did this happen at the same exact time as the State Department hack, or were these separate attacks?
So it wasn't the same exact time. The hackers, the State Department hack, first of all, was happening for months. It was a sustained hack on their systems. And the hackers actually used the access that they gained through hacking the State Department to gain access to the White House files as well.
Now, has the White House been hacked before? Is this an unprecedented hack, or is this another example of a hack that's of a kind that has taken place before?
So it's definitely not the first time that the White House has had breaches on their computer systems. You know, we've seen years of hacks from the Chinese, particularly. There was a major one in 2008, again, I think in 2011 and 2012. So this isn't something new for the White House. It is significant right now, though, as it's coming at a time when the president is pursuing a pretty aggressive cybersecurity agenda.
You know, it seems to me that, and this is sort of outside the scope of your article, that the White House has all the systems around the president that are designed to protect the president and the White House and the executive branch are failing. You got Secret Service failures. You got drones coming over the White House fence. You have people actually entering the White House. And now you have, you know, the Chinese and Russian hackers compromising the White House system and learning the president's personal schedule and so on. There seems to be a trend here where we used to think that, you know, all of the people around the president that used to protect him were just like the best in the world and like really did this great job. And it seems like they're just failing at every level. And again, that's not what your article was about. And I'm not going to ask you a question about that, but I just wanted to make that observation. I thought that was very, very strange. Kat Zakrzewski is at TechCrunch.com. You can follow her on Twitter at Kat_Zakrzewski. Her last name is spelled Zakrzewski. Thank you so much for joining us, Kat.
Thanks so much.
All right. Tesla today introduced the Model S70D, which replaces the existing low-end Tesla, low-end with quotation marks, the Model S. Damon Lavrance is Silicon Valley editor for Jalopnik and joins us to talk about it. Hey, Damon, how's it going?
Great, Mike. How about yourself?
Going great, thanks. Now, what are the biggest improvements in this model, assuming there are improvements?
Well, it's primarily a boost in the battery upgrade. So we've got the old kind of entry-level model. And like you said, in quotes on that one, you know, 70 grand is hardly entry-level for the majority of the population. But it's gone from a 60 kilowatt-hour battery pack to a 70 kilowatt-hour battery pack. And that's now netting about 240 miles of range rated by the EPA. They've also added the new dual motor system. So the car now essentially has all-wheel drive. So it's got a motor in the rear and then a separate motor up front. And that pays dividends both on performance and wet weather and snow and that kind of thing. But Tesla is also promising that they can optimize the drivetrain to be more efficient at high speeds by kind of tweaking the motor power between the two.
Can you talk a little bit about pricing? Just because my understanding was that these cars were always supposed to get a little bit less expensive. This one seems to be more, and I'm wondering if it matters either way for Tesla to continue to have, you know, such high-priced vehicles.
You know, the pricing of the Model S has always been a bit of an issue. From what we found talking to owners and also talking with Tesla, the majority of owners generally just opted for the 85 kilowatt hour model, so the highest one possible. And the reason for that was basically once they chose like the 60 kilowatt hour model, they started adding options. And at a certain point, the price had gotten so high that they figured, well, if I'm going to drop this kind of cash on the car, I might as well get the biggest battery with the most performance and the most range. You know, right now we're at a point where we're not going to see an inexpensive model from Tesla for at least 3 to 4 years. You know, they're shooting for 2017, 2018 for the Model 3, which is going to be more of a 3 series competitor. They're saying pricing is going to be right around $35,000. But for now, this is still very much a luxury vehicle and should be considered as such.
Maybe I'll start a Kickstarter to get myself one. Now, the 70D has autopilot hardware. Does that mean this is a self-driving car?
Hardly. It's getting there. But a couple things about that. First of all, it's got the hardware, but the software hasn't been released yet. So Tesla announced this last year, but they have a tendency to kind of delay rolling out things to make sure everything works properly. They tend to overpromise a little bit sometimes, maybe. But the thing with autopilot is it's a combination of stuff we've seen on other cars for decades, something like adaptive cruise control, where you set the speed, it's got a sonar system in front, and it can detect the vehicle in front of you and then maintain the speed, slowing down, accelerating, braking, that kind of thing to keep up. This also has essentially a self-steering feature, so it keeps track of the lines, two cameras that are mounted, keep track of the lines in the road, and you can actually take your hands off the wheel and the car will fall along that path. Tesla hasn't really gotten the details about exactly what speeds it's going to be capable of going through and that kind of thing. But it's you know, when it comes to autonomous vehicles in general, it's always about these really small incremental improvements. And we're slowly kind of getting there. And this is just yet another step in that direction.
I'd like to see a Tesla that pays for itself instead of drives itself, but that's just me. Damon Lavrence is at DamonLavrence.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Damon Lavrence. Thank you so much for joining us today, Damon.
Thanks, Mike. Have a great one.
All right. A company called Oyster, which makes a book rental app, announced that it's launching an ebook store to compete with the likes of Amazon, Apple, Google, and Barnes & Noble. Nat Guerin is U.S. editor for The Next Web and joins us now. Hey, Nat, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing great, thank you. Now, what are they, nuts? What makes them think they won't be crushed by Amazon?
Well, you know, it has a different pay model that it allegedly offers publishers. What Oyster does different from Amazon is that from the subscription models, it kind of measures how users are getting along through the book, you know, and it pays a portion to the publishers based on how much of the book readers have gone through. So that's kind of interesting. So I think they're kind of just expanding on that model and moving on to ebooks because they want to keep Oyster users within the app and not have to exit the app and go back to the Kindle app to download books that aren't currently available through their subscription.
Okay, so what does this mean for pricing for consumers? What's the bottom line there? Because Amazon competes on price so aggressively.
I got to say, the pricing hasn't been, it is competitive, but it's definitely not as cheap as Amazon. In some books, for example, Random House is one of the publishers that partnered with Oyster for this launch. And I just checked the Becoming Steve Jobs book that launched a few weeks ago. And on Oyster, it's about $12, $13. And on Amazon Kindle, it's about $10, $11. So it's not as cheap. But if you are an Oyster user and you like the interface, I think that you might enjoy it better. And, you know, like I personally like the UI a lot. So if that extra $2 matters to you in terms of more comfortable user design, then maybe it'll work. But I think they definitely have a long way to go in terms of just competitive pricing.
Are you an Oyster user yourself? And if so, what do you think of the app in general?
I use it occasionally. I don't have time to read books as much as I'd like, unfortunately. But yeah, I think the app is nice. They received a UI overhaul a few months ago, and I think it's, you know, it's colorful. It's really pleasing to the eye. It's minimal, and I personally enjoy all those things. I prefer that over the really simplistic Kindle layout. So yeah, it's really just preferential.
I see. Well, Nat Guerin is at thenextweb.com. You can follow her on Twitter at Nat Guerin. That's Nat with two T's, G-A-R-U-N. Thank you for joining us today, Nat.
My pleasure.
Well, Google appears to be testing a new meetings service called Google Meetings, or G-Meet. The idea is to schedule and join conference calls with a single click. G Meet is based on Google Hangouts, as you might expect. Reports suggest that there will be at least an Android app and a Chrome extension to enable G Meet. Katie, what's your confidence that they'll pull this off if they do, in fact, roll this out to the public, that they'll pull it off in a way that isn't confusing or difficult as Google Hangouts stuff tends to be?
Oh, gosh. So, yeah, it'll probably be confusing and difficult, just like Google Hangouts. But the thing is, a lot of people already use Google Hangouts for group meetings for work. So this is sort of a natural extension of that. Hopefully they'll be able to get it right. It seems like they're just trying to work out some of the bugs that business users are encountering. But this is Google, so they're not really great with consumer-facing things. This probably won't be very smooth, and the user interface probably won't be much better.
And I'm personally a little confused about exactly where they're at with the Google Voice integration. My understanding was that they were integrating Google Voice into Hangouts, but now they both still seem to exist, and all the features in Google Voice is not available in Hangouts. And it's not clear that this is something that should have been in Voice rather than Hangouts. I'm not really clear about their strategy or even about their current status as a company that lets you make phone calls in interesting ways.
I don't think they are either, to be completely honest. And I think that a lot of the reporting that you read around Google sort of hints at the fact that this is a huge company with tons of employees, lots of divisions that are kind of sometimes doing the same thing and competing with one another too. So we saw that with the Google TV stuff, where you had different divisions working on the same project as competitors within the company. And so it's no surprise when you see sort of confusing, overlapping products coming out of Google.
Absolutely true. Well, in follow-up, Getty Images has dropped the lawsuit we told you about in September against Microsoft over alleged copyright infringement. Instead, both companies announced a partnership to bring Getty Photos to Bing and Cortana through co-developed apps. And oftentimes, lawsuits are just a negotiating tactic to get people to the meeting room and so that you can hash out a deal like this one. So this is... I guess this is good news for people who like pretty pictures in and use Bing, because, of course, Getty has a fantastic catalog. Well, in product update news, the image hosting platform Imgur launched a new embed feature which provides code you can copy and paste. The embed code attributes the photo to its source, or at least to the person who posted it on Imgur. In other related news, Amazon Echo now supports Wemo and Hue, enabling you to tell Amazon's Alexa personal assistant to turn on and off the lights and play music or do whatever Wemo and Hue enables you to do. This is pretty cool. My son actually ordered an Echo, and he also uses Wemo. So I'm looking forward to going to his house and telling the house to turn the lights on and off. So that's going to be pretty cool. Katie, have you tried Echo by any chance?
You know, I haven't yet.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's what's interesting about it is it's the right idea to be able to talk to this really high quality speaker and have it talk back to you and play things and do things. It's just that Alexa is not as good as Siri or Google Now, and probably not as good as Cortana either. And it'd be great to marry that concept with a better assistant, and especially an assistant that knows more about you personally, like Google Now does or like Siri does. So I'm excited about this category, and it's inevitable, I think, that all of the major personal virtual assistants will have appliances like this that you can just talk to in the room and you don't have to pull out your phone and that kind of thing. Well, in product obituary news, Google is killing off Google Moderator on July 31st. The crowdsourcing service ranked user-submitted questions. Users can download their Google Moderator data from Google Takeout, where it'll be available for at least 2 years. Did you ever use Google Moderator, Katie? Because I never did.
No, I'm going to say I've never used Google Moderator, and I don't actually know anybody who used Google Moderator.
Yeah, this is like one of those Yahoo announcements where they announce the closure of something, and you're like, wow, I would have used that if I'd have known about it. Well, it happens. Okay, so in mergers and acquisitions, Singapore Telecommunications is buying the American cybersecurity firm Trustwave for $810 million. And that's an interesting thing for them in Singapore because they are expanding. This is a case of a company that used to have a narrow mission that's expanding into a more broad mission, and they're doing it. And I think it's probably wise for them to have a security element to it, to what they're doing. So that looks very, very interesting. Well, we got some more news for you in just a minute. But first, let's talk about Gazelle. Gazelle can buy your used gadgets. Of course, we got an Apple Watch coming up. And how are you going to pay for it? Well, one way to help you pay for it is to sell whatever gadgets you've got lying around. And I've always believed that, you know, some people think, well, you know, for the environment, I should buy a device and use it for as many years as I possibly can. I personally disagree with that. I think the thing to do is to put your device back into circulation, give it to somebody who's going to love it just as much as you did. And Gazelle is the way to do that. They'll buy any sort of device, like an Android device or an Apple. They'll buy an Apple laptop or desktop. They'll even buy your old Apple iPod, believe it or not. And they will sell devices to you as well. And, of course, they're in one category of device, certified like new. These are just like brand new phones and tablets. In certified good category, there's some gentle signs of wear, but you're going to get an amazing price. And this is really the way to help the environment. The only environmentally friendly smartphone or tablet is the one that's never manufactured in the first place. And the way you prevent them from being manufactured, theoretically, is you put it back, you put the stuff that's lying around the house back into circulation. So that person, so somebody else somewhere will buy a pre-owned device instead of a new one that has to be manufactured with a very environmentally unfriendly process, which all smartphones are, in fact, manufactured in a very environmentally unfriendly process. Find out what your iPhone's worth. Take a minute and go to Gazelle.com to find out. And we thank Gazelle for their support of Tech News Today. We got some email about the Ride carpooling app we talked about yesterday, one from Chris Clark, who said the following in an email. He said, I can see the Ride carpooling app being beneficial in areas like Washington, D.C., where the traffic is horrible and there are HOV three lanes. Some people are so desperate to get into those HOV lanes, they participate in what's known as slugging. And he provided a link to the Wikipedia entry for slugging. It's basically how people just form ad hoc carpools so they can just to get into that lane. Perhaps this new carpooling app, he writes, can be expanded to non-coworkers to show some love to the slugs. And Katie Benner, I don't know if you've been following the story about the Ride app, but basically what it does is they approach the companies and they try to get the companies to organize employees to give each other rides to work. And I think the reason that they're approaching companies instead of individuals is that the companies, you know, it's that individuals don't want a carpool. People like to drive their own car or whatever, whereas if the company is kind of organizing it and it's part of a larger company program that may involve inadequate numbers of parking spaces or whatever, incentives or whatever,
that may be more successful. The company can incentivize its own employees in a way that, you know, Uber and Lyft, they do rideshare too, but a company can actually go in and say to its employee base, we'll give you something for doing this. Like, we'll, whether it's, you know, bonuses or something for using the service. And so that takes some of the pressure off of Ride to do marketing, which is expensive.
Exactly. And it sounds like a good idea in theory. We'll see if it really takes off. And of course, they manage the route. They manage who drives and who's a rider. They manage the sharing of funds and tolls and gas and all the rest. So there's probably a good need for this. And it'll be interesting to see if it takes off as Uber has been. Very interesting story. And thank you for that email. Well, our TNT fan of the day is Michael D. in Puyallup, Washington, who posted this video on YouTube and shared it on Twitter. Let's take a look at the video.
Here's a rental car, and screen goes up, screen goes down, screen goes up, screen goes down, screen goes up.
There we go, third time. So sometimes renting a car can be fun, and we thank him for that video. We love to see your videos. How do you watch or listen to TNT? Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup and post it on Google+, Twitter, or Facebook, and use the hashtag HowIWatchTNT, and we'll find it. Katie Benner, thank you so much for co-anchoring today. What are you working on, and where can people read it?
You can go to BloombergView.com to read all of my columns, as well as opinion stories that have been written by fantastic colleagues covering Wall Street, energy, what's happening in Europe, and politics. So you should definitely do that. And right now I'm following everything from Twitter rumors, that Google Twitter deal that I just don't think is going to happen.
You go on, can we talk about that for a sec? Because what you're mentioning, because we haven't mentioned this on the show yet because it is so speculative, but basically Twitter's stock is going nuts because there are rumors that somebody, and people are pointing the finger at Google, may want to acquire Twitter. Now, these rumors have existed before, and it's just crazy to consider, but personally, I think that would be amazing. I think a lot of Twitter users would hate it, but I personally would love it because I always use Twitter as a feature of Google Plus. So you don't think this rumor is going to happen either, do you?
No, I think the most interesting thing is how much the stock has moved on the rumor, much more than it's moved on anything that Twitter itself has announced recently. I mean, it's clear that investors, they're still unhappy with the fact that Twitter's not going to be Facebook. They still probably haven't come to terms with that. And they are more excited about these rumors than they are about anything that the company actually does.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, well, Kate, you can follow Katie's work on Twitter. Her Twitter handle is KT, the letter K, letter T, and then Benner, B-E-N-N-E-R. Katie, thank you so much for co-anchoring today, and we will see you next time.
All right, thank you.
All right, take care. Well, you can subscribe to Tech News Today on Stitcher, and please leave a review and let us know how you like the show. You can choose your favorite way to subscribe at twit.tv/TNT. You can also watch us live every weekday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, 1800 UTC at live.twit.tv or on the app or browser plugin of your choice. You can find those apps and browser plugins at twit.tv/apps. Of course, you can follow us too on Twitter at Tech News Today TV, or you can subscribe to our subreddit at technewstoday.reddit.com. You can also follow me personally on Google+. Just go to googleplus.com/plusMikeElgin. Let us know what you think. Send us email to tnt@twit.tv or call 260-TNT-SHOW. And don't miss our Tech News Tonight at 4 p.m. Pacific every single weeknight. And that is the Tech News Today. My name's Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.